Welcome to FHSU Tilt Talk, a podcast about educational technologies, teaching and learning, scholarly research and service, hosted by Teaching Innovation and Learning Technologies staff.
I'm Cheryl Duffy. I've been an English professor at Fort Hays State University for over 30 years, and I direct freshman composition and chair the Writing Across the Curriculum Committee. With me today is Sydney Dobrin. Hi, Sydney.
Please, Sid.
Okay, I knew that, but you know, I didn't know how official we wanted to be. He's the author of AI in Writing, and he'll be the keynote speaker for the FHSU mini-conference of the same title. He's professor and chair of the Department of English at the University of Florida, and for 10 years he directed the writing program. So my lead question is, how does an English professor guy like you end up as one of the foremost experts in AI in higher education?
Well, you know, I'm going to give you the soundbite answer first. And the soundbite answer is that English departments study what people read and write and how they read and write. And those things have drastically changed. And a lot of those changes come from emerging and evolving technology. So the things that we see being done in augmented reality and virtual reality and artificial intelligence create new writing environments and new ways of thinking about what writing actually is. So that's why I come at it from an English department. But, you know, I get asked this question a lot, and I've had to spend some time thinking about, well, why is it that I got into emerging and evolving technologies? And I think a lot of it has to do both with my educational background, but also just cultural background. I mean, as a kid in the 70s, you know, when C-3PO walked out onto the screen, there's that immediate mental question of, oh my God, the robots are actually now interacting like humans. But from that cultural perspective, I think there was a book that was published in 1982, and it's got a weird title, so forgive me. And back then, you know, I was pure punk, so the title was one of those books that if somebody saw it on my desk, I knew it was going to annoy them. And the title was Satan, His Psychotherapy and Cure by the Unfortunate Dr. Kassler, JSPS. And it was written by Jeremy Levin in 1982. And the book, in hindsight, I think about it, the short precis of the book is that one of the main characters starts having this recurring dream about being on a train with Albert Einstein, and Einstein's trying to teach him these schematics. And so he figures, well, maybe in the mornings I should start writing down what the schematics are, and they start to piece together to build a computerized brain. And it turns out to be the brains of Satan, and Satan wants to be psychoanalyzed. But a big chunk of the book is that question of, can you build a mechanical brain? And so I think that triggered a lot for me back then. In that same year, Rudy Rucker's first book from the Ware trilogy, I think that was the software book, which is a heavy AI book, came out, and I read it at the same time. So I think there was always that presence of the stuff I was seeing, the stuff I was reading, was really driving me toward this concept of thinking about evolving and emerging technologies. And then back in, God, when was it, 2009? Was that when, I'm blanking on names now, Peter Norvig and come on, Brain, I've even got Peter Russell and Peter Norvig launched that first Stanford MOOC on AI. And I didn't take it the first year, but I think 2 years later, I signed up to take this MOOC on AI. And it was really interesting. And, you know, Stuart Russell and Norvig are, you know, huge names in AI, but I couldn't do the
memorable
math.
Names.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Memorable names. That's right. But I couldn't do the math part of it. I don't have the math background coming out of English or coming out of the humanities. You know, in English, we prefer after math to math. So, but I think it was at that point, probably around 2010, where I started really focusing on learning more about AI. And then because of that, because of some other work I had done, two things happened. The first was that just before COVID, the University of Florida, one of our alum happens to be the CEO of NVIDIA, and NVIDIA donated the second fastest academic supercomputer to UF, along with about $50 million, to which the university capped it off with, I think, another $70 million to create UF's AI initiative. And since that time, we've hired over 120 faculty working in AI. We're rebranding as the AI University. So there was this large presence of AI on our campus. And in November 2022, when OpenAI dropped ChatGPT, the university held a symposium on generative AI, and I was one of the three or four speakers at that. And I think it was called Big Bots on Campus or something, you know, just great like that. Anyway, I gave a short talk about generative AI right as everybody was just jaw-dropped about what do we do about ChatGPT. And that started circulating, and the next thing I know, I'm getting invitations just around the world. And so I've had to seriously immerse myself over these last 2 years in both a conceptual and a practical way of studying AI. And so that's really been my primary focus these last 2 or 3 years.
Well, I think some of us would be a little bit jealous of you because we've got the jaw drop, but we don't really have the background. Many of us feel as though the AI floodgates have opened, and here comes this wall of water. And we're just not ready for it.
I don't think anybody in the world was ready for it, to be honest.
So my question is, what do we do to get ready? That is, what should individual faculty be doing? What should colleges and universities as a whole be doing?
Yeah, that's the big question. And the reality is that question is spanning every kind of institution in higher ed around the world right now, whether it's the R1s or whether it's the small two-year vo-tech schools. That's what everybody's asking. And the reality is there's no solid answer to that question, because the answer to that question is very contextual. So what somebody wants to do or should do in, say, a first-year writing class at a large state university is going to be very different from what a pharmacy nursing program at a two-year school is going to need to do with it. So the pragmatic approaches are going to vary, not just contextually by institution or discipline, but right down to the individual instructor who's trying to figure out, where does this fit into my educational philosophies? And so for a while, we're going to see that sort of weird bell curve of those folks who are evangelists and they want students to understand this. They want to learn how to use it. And then at the opposite end of that, you're going to have those faculty, those instructors who are absolutely resistant. I don't want this in my classroom. It changes the fundamentals of education. I don't believe in this. But most everybody's somewhere in the middle trying to figure out, what do I do with this? So when I get asked, what should we be doing with this, right now is a lot of experimentation and having a lot of conversations, trying to figure out, where do we want this to fit? So for instance, one of the kinds of ways we can start to think about this is, how do we think about our role in higher ed in preparing students for intellectual purpose or for workplace purpose, or what is it that we want our students to walk away with? And so for a lot of institutions, workplace readiness has become a very primary driver of why students go to school and also how we're designing curriculum. And that's always been the case in a lot of instances. A lot of our curriculum in higher education is industry dependent, right? If you're in engineering or if you're in nursing or pharmacy, you're training to get a particular set of credentials so that you can get licensure and you can get, you know, the opportunity to practice. So industry has always informed curriculum, and from a workplace readiness position, the more that AI is integrating into industry around the world, the more that notion of AI literacy becomes important. And of course, you know, for the last, 8-10 years, every university in the country, perhaps in the world, has been focused on digital literacy approaches to how are we going to make sure our students are digitally literate. Well, now AI literacy rises to the top of what that digital literacy has to look like. So those are kind of the places that I start asking the questions, well, what should we do? And so, for instance, in a writing classroom, you know, what we should do is a different kind of AI literacy necessarily than, say, in a computer science, in an engineering program, because you're approaching a different set of literacy tasks and a different set of deployment tasks. How is AI going to be used in these different places? So when I get asked questions like that, where I really have to answer is, there is no answer. What there is the opportunity to start saying, how are we going to ask these questions? And I've worked with lots of task force around the world, actually, in talking about how do you start asking those questions for your institution.
Sure. Well, and you talked about writing, and I know that you, like me, have a background in composition and writing studies. So here are my related big questions. Will it still be important or even necessary, given Gen AI's potential, for students to learn how to write?
Well,
and if so, how do we teach writing in a Gen AI environment?
Sure. So my answer is going to be yes, absolutely. Teaching writing is going to be important.
I had a feeling.
But I think that just like if we even look at the disciplinary history of rhetoric and composition of writing studies, technology has always had a big impact on how we have adjusted what writing studies is. With the back in the late 80s, early 90s, we even formed, computers in composition to start asking those questions about how basic computer skills play into writing skills, how they tie into research skills. We started adjusting a lot of our pedagogical approaches to taking into consideration those technologies. And, you got to keep in mind, too, that even if we look away from the institutional history of writing studies, that writing technologies have had impacts on what writing is, what writing culture is, what human culture is, since the outset. I mean, we can trace back what happened when, the introduction of the printing press or the introduction of the pencil or the ballpoint pen and the absolute, cultural moral crisis about ballpoint pens or chalkboards or, every single writing technology.
Even just writing as a technology, those who were of the oral tradition felt that, now we won't be able to think anymore if we can just write things down.
That's the Phaedrus right there in a nutshell, right? That's Plato saying writing is not what we should be doing. It's affected us throughout, but what's always happened is that there's been an adjustment. Think about 20 years ago when Wikipedia came out and how there were calls all around the world, this has to be banned, students will never do real research, they'll never think again. Now it's listed as a learning tool. It's just how we do things. And this is what happens with all technology. Not just writing technologies, but literally all technologies. They have two paths. They either become obsolete because they've solved the problem they were designed for, or more likely because a better technology has come along to solve that problem, or they get naturalized into the background of the way we do things. The example I always give is the spoon. Nobody gets up in the morning and is stirring their coffee with a spoon and looks at the spoon and goes, wow, what an amazing piece of technology. But it is. It changed social dynamics. It changed public health. It changed aesthetics. It had tremendous impact on, and there's a whole approach to materialism in spoons and where they were made. It literally changed human culture, but it became naturalized into the background. And this is just how we do things. This is how we solve the problem of having an instrument to stir our coffee. The same kinds of things happen with academic technologies. Wikipedia is the easy example, or the calculator in the 1970s, which I think is a bad example in a lot of ways, but it's an easy example because everybody thought, students will never have to learn basic arithmetic again. But what they've learned well exceeds learning basic arithmetic. And so in a writing classroom, when I think about Gen Tech, I kind of think about it as we want our students to get from a certain point to another point throughout the course of a writing semester. And Gen AI will certainly right now help them get from A to B, but we really want our students at E, F, and G. And so what this allows us to do is to focus on those bigger skills rather than those sort of mundane skills, basic writing skills that we don't necessarily want to address in the classroom. So what I see Gen AI doing is sort of becoming naturalized into the process, just the way that grammar checkers and spell checkers and word processors have in terms of what we require for writing students. I mean, I'm actually intrigued by this concept. I keep meaning to get in touch with the publishers of Blue Books to see if Blue Book sales have increased since all this started.
I know of someone, you know, here at Fort Hays who has, out of frustration, move to Blue Books, kind of the flipped classroom where what we're going to do in class is write. And you know, that brings me to that my next question, which is the question everyone is asking, and I'm sure you have an answer for it, and that is, how do you address the ethical considerations surrounding the use of generative AI? You know, that question of plagiarism, intellectual property.
Yeah, that has been the primary question since OpenAI dropped ChatGPT, and primarily, I think that conversation emerged because popular press started to represent generative AI and ChatGPT as the cheater's tool. Mm-hmm. And that question of plagiarism, that question of academic integrity got forefronted there, and it sort of then retroactively played back on those of us in higher ed trying to figure out these questions. And I'm going to tell you that I don't like talking about the plagiarism issue for a very specific reason. A lot of that conversation is more about how am I going to catch my students when they're using this. You know, does the Turnitin.com AI detector actually work? And for me, those are all conversations about policing mechanisms, about catching students. And I'm not interested in catching students doing things wrong. I'm more interested in education and discovery than I am in policing. And so the way that I address the integrity question, first of all, is not just to address this as an academic integrity question, but to address this as a larger academic, professional, personal, civic integrity question. And that allows me then to address Gen AI in terms of responsible use. And being able to talk about how technology, any technology, can be used for nefarious purposes, right? A lot of times the intent in the development of a technology doesn't account for all the ways it might be used negatively. Like, you know, I'm sure that whoever invented men's neckties was not thinking about how many people would eventually be tied up by men's neckties, right? So I don't like to talk about catching students plagiarizing. What I'm more interested in is teaching students how these tools can be used responsibly in a lot of different contexts. Because the fact of the matter is, whether you ban it from the classroom or whether you tell your students they're not learning when they use it, they're using it. And I'd rather teach them to use it in responsible ways. But that's got to be part of my rhetoric background, right? This is Aristotle and classical rhetoric, good men speaking well kinds of things, right? Language is a powerful technology, and this is just another powerful technology that we have to learn how to use responsibly. I also think that part of that question, and it goes back also to the Blue Book scenario, is that we've only been in this conversation, right, since November of 2022. So we're still trying to figure a lot of stuff out. So there aren't a lot of answers. But a lot of the responses to Gen AI in the classroom, in higher ed, in writing classrooms, is based on this weird kind of educational nostalgia. I learned in a particular way. I turned out pretty awesome. So if my students learn the same way, they're going to turn out pretty awesome. And that grows from sort of a foundational educational epistemology of what our students are supposed to get in a classroom. Well, Gen AI is giving us the opportunity to rethink, why is it that they're supposed to get those skills? Why is it that we teach in these particular ways? And a lot of those conversations revolve around how Gen AI or how AI are assisting in or augmenting or automating the things we've already done. And so a lot of times in a writing classroom, when we talk about Gen AI, a lot of those conversations are, how can you use this to keep doing the things that you used to do? When in fact, the more important question is, how can we use these tools to do things we haven't figured out yet, with the what comes next question? And so I see a lot of that plagiarism conversation, a lot of that Blue Book kind of approach, as a way of trying to protect a tradition of education that Gen AI is giving us the opportunity to start to question. And to me, that's the important part.
Okay, to play devil's advocate a bit, you knew I was going to do that. You know, what if looking at, you know, using blue books to have students write in the classroom is not a form of nostalgia for the way we used to do things or for tradition, but just is something that's grounded in a belief that the writing that I produce as an individual, the words that I form and the thinking that I do and then put in writing is the best place to start. And you use Blue Books as a way to ensure that that's where students are starting, especially, I think, you know, you talked about contextualizing all of this. I think you have to contextualize, say, freshman composition, right, Comp 1 versus an upper-level course where students are learning how to use AI responsibly in their discipline. But I think maybe with freshmen, part of teaching them the responsible use of AI is letting them start with their own voices and their own words.
See, I love that question because one of the big things that this conversation about Gen AI has allowed us to really dive into is that question of the autonomous student subject. It's an opportunity to really question why we have created that construct of the student as an individual, as an autonomous subject, having individual identity, rather than looking at network knowledge, networked abilities to do things. You know, the sort of cultural approach that you are an amalgam.
Collective.
Right, you are an amalgam of your world. And this gives us a chance to ask, well, why are we asking these questions about individual students? And if we take that back to the integrity question, one of the things that I like about the integrity question is it also allows us to move that question into that question of assessment. How am I assessing individual student knowledge, and where does that come into the plagiarism conversation? And why, in doing that, am I operating under this philosophy that when a student comes to an institution of higher learning, I am supposed to assess them as an individual object rather than as how are they integrating into a larger kind of network learning environment. So I don't know, have an answer to that. I don't even know, honestly, if I completely believe or want to give up on the idea of the independent student subject, but the autonomous subject is a big question now with Gen AI.
Well, and I'm just, you know, this is my field, it's my life. This is the reason I went into this whole field, this discipline of writing, was because of what writing did for me as an individual who writes. Okay, so it's a matter of bringing students to voice and letting it be their voice. And, you know, going back to Stephen North's, you know, our goal better writing or better writers? And AI is going to help you produce better writing. And I'm sure you would argue we're going to find ways to use AI to become better writers as well. But I think becoming a better writer is, and also coming to voice through writing, is a part of what we do. I mean, even if you look at expressivism, which is the notion that I'm just for our audience, you know, I'm not explaining to you, but, you know, expressivism, the notion that I write to express the self as opposed to, you know, accomplish some academic purpose or something like that, you know, that's still important. I still include that as a part of my freshman composition teaching, even though I know some who don't because they discount it. But
I mean, that's the interesting question too there is, you know, even as you and I are talking about this with all of our combined experience in writing theory and writing instruction, we're still talking about writing as an umbrella term, right? Nobody says that AI has to interfere with the individual writer's development of their writing. Nobody says that the creative writer, the novelist, has to turn to AI now to write the novel, the poem, whatever it happens to be. Again, it goes back to the context. You know, think about the difference of introducing generative AI in a professional communication or technical writing course versus a freshman English course, where you're really, I mean, let's face it, a first-year writing course in higher ed is designed to teach students to acclimate to the academic environment, to standard written English. I mean, it is a device used to sort of homogenize the student subject into the academy. And I think if, as long as we continue to talk about writing writ large and Gen AI, there are too many nuances in there to say AI will do this to writing. But at the same time, some of the Gen AI is producing some incredible fiction, you know, incredible poetry. It's doing these amazing things. I think it just really boils down to, we can't have these blanket definitions or these blanket assumptions that everything is, particularly now, as we're trying to figure all this out, it's just too contextual. And I know that may seem like a cop-out answer, you know, oh, he's just going to say it's different everywhere. But I do think that if you're teaching a technical writing course with the intent that your students are thinking of taking the tech writing course because they're thinking career trajectory, and that you're not integrating how does AI play into everything from single sourcing to what are the new genres, you know, I'll say this over and over again in the talks I give. I don't like to make predictions about technology, emerging technologies, but the one prediction I do make is that, you know, 15 years ago, there's not a company on this planet that would have imagined they needed something called a social media marketing manager. And now, even if it's a small garage-based mom-and-pop kind of business, somebody has to be doing social media stuff for the business too. Prompt engineering is next. Prompt engineering is what every company is going to need, somebody who knows how to work with AI for content creation. And I think that being able to say to a tech writing class, let's think about prompt engineering and the role of technical writing, that's part of the AI literacy that students need to walk away from classes like that with. I think in a first-year writing classroom, being able to say, all right, everybody's heard about ChatGPT, and I think in that class, there's a point to say, let's talk about how we can responsibly use this or not use this in the academic setting. Here's what I want you to do in my class, or here's what I don't want you to do in my class. And I think getting that out on the table starts to alleviate the integrity question. It starts to alleviate the AI literacy question. And it starts to let, you know, first-year students know, this is something that's out there, and I have to think of how it fits into what I do as a college student.
And you may have already addressed this next question, which is, but maybe I'm looking for something more specific. I'm wondering if you could share some examples of what that successful implementation of generative AI in writing instruction at the university level might look like. And I want, because I'm director of comp, I want to start with freshman comp.
So if we start with freshman comp, there are a couple of avenues to pursue there. The first is, I think we have to think about the deployment of Gen AI in freshman comp across higher ed, both from the student perspective and the faculty perspective. There are some amazing things that Gen AI can do for you as a writing teacher. Let me give you a quick example from my own experience. So I taught a course 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, called Digital Literacy in the Humanities. And I really liked teaching the course. The students liked it. And then, of course, OpenAI drops ChatGPT since I've taught the course. So I have to now figure out, how do I reconfigure this course in the age of generative AI? So I took a particular AI platform, and I'm not shilling for platforms. I'm not going to tell you which one it is. I took that course description, and I put it into the AI, and I said, rewrite this course description to take into account what has happened to writing technologies and digital literacy since OpenAI dropped ChatGPT. I blinked my eyes and I had a whole new description that actually pulled that in. It fit, it worked. But the more exciting part for me as a teacher was I went to the bottom section of the syllabus, right, where you've got your daily calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And I had taught that in fall of whatever, 2021 or whatever when it was. And I cut, paste that into the Gen AI and I said, redevise this to account for being taught in spring 2025. And I blinked, and there it was, all the dates, all the holidays, everything reconfigured.
Holy
right.
crap.
So the mundane became more efficient. Now, all of a sudden, certain tasks, I don't have to spend hours going, what was I doing on that Tuesday? I've also worked with faculty at various institutions to figure out how can Gen AI help develop rubrics, student learning outcomes. There are lots of things there. But what I want to emphasize in our work as teachers there, just as I do with any other deployment of generative AI, we don't necessarily want to approach this as automation. We want to approach this as augmentation. Because if we're just asking it to do our job for us, we're going to run into all kinds of problems. So I use it to make recommendations. I think of it as it's recommending how I should revise the calendar, how I should revise the description. And then I'm going back and, you know, doing that. But it's a great time saver. It's very efficient. And depending on the platform you're using, it can be very accurate. So from a teacherly perspective, that's beneficial. It's also beneficial from the teacherly perspective because it can do assessments of the mundane, right? It can tell me where the grammar mistakes or where the spelling mistake, that I don't have to sit there and go through every single one. And you can also build out some macros and some other kinds of boilerplates that says you have a comma error here, you know, and it tells you here's where you look in the handbook, you know, and set all that up. So you have to do some front-loaded labor, but in the long term, it saves a lot of labor. And the truth of the matter is also, I don't know about in your writing classroom, but if a student's turning in a paper to me that has spelling mistakes and grammar mistakes, my first response is, why do you not have your grammar checker and your spell checker on in your word processor anyway? Because all of a sudden, I feel insulted that I have to do the labor of what these tools have been around for a very long time to do. And what Gen AI does is let me expand what I can lean on for those tools. Now, you also asked, you're asking sort of a question also about what assignments have I seen that are effective. Most of the assignments that I see right now that people are doing are comparative assignments. They have students respond to a prompt, and again, that goes back to, as writing teachers, we know that writing a prompt is a writing task in and of itself, and so the better prompts we write, the better output we get, just like with Gen AI. But they'll ask students to write a document. And I'm pausing there for a second to take a quick tangential exit. I didn't say essay, because even though the research shows that freshman English, mostly the essay is being taught, I happen to agree with Adam Banks and everyone else that the essay needs to be pushed aside. This is not a genre that we need to be teaching in the academy any longer. There are other kinds of genres. AI teaches us a lot about that. But I think that those comparative assignments give us the opportunity for students to start thinking about, in your language before, about where am I in this versus where is the machine in this. Mm-hmm. And that can be very valuable in getting them to begin to understand those bigger conceptual questions about generative AI and the work that they do. Now, I do get the question a lot, well, what percentage of a paper should be the student's original writing? And I'm not answering that, right? Because, you know, that's just looking for a quantifiable way to assess writing. And
never been one.
Right. And I'm certainly not going to contribute to that conversation. And the same holds true that, you know, for the last 8-10 years, we've been having in the field multiple arguments about machine grading and, you know, whether we should be, you know, assessing writing with grading. But there are valuable tools here, particularly, you know, as I recommend to TAs, adjuncts, other part-timers, those who are, you know, what we call the Rhodes Scholar, bouncing from college, you know, campus to campus, teaching 4-5, 5-5 loads, that this is an opportunity to reduce your workload very efficiently. So there's some valuable tool there as well. So one of the coolest assignments that I have seen or one of the coolest deployments of Gen AI that I have seen actually came from an art teacher. And she had her students engaging with Michelangelo's works and all the criticism written about Michelangelo and Michelangelo's letters and everything. And so she took a chatbot platform and dumped every single piece of text that she could find about Michelangelo into the chatbot. So now if the students have a question about Michelangelo's letter to whomever or, you know, the contract, they ask the chatbot, and the chatbot creates a dialogue about that content. Now the students are retaining more information because of that, not having to sit down, right? The dialogue rather than having to sit and read a JSTOR article about Michelangelo. And I thought that was pretty savvy. I want to say one other thing on this, too, that I don't think we've touched on that I think is important. We're talking about Gen AI and writing. And when OpenAI in November of 2022 dropped ChatGPT on the world, it made writing the proving ground for AI in higher ed. But the fact of the matter is that Gen AI operates in almost every other discipline other than writing as well. We know that it's fantastic at coding. We know that it's fantastic at computation, at music construction, at film construction, at image generation. And yet, for some reason, the hill everybody wants to die on is writing. And for those of us in composition studies who know the history of writing instruction in the American Academy, to me, this is kind of an excellent opportunity to say, you know, we've actually been talking about this for a very long time. And so it gives us an opportunity to say, well, let's talk about what writing actually is then and how we can think about Gen AI. And when I consult on campuses all over the world and I'm meeting with task force and administrators, one of the things that I emphasize is any conversation you have about Gen AI on this campus, you have to include your composition faculty, your writing center faculty, and your libraries too, because that's the entity on campus that has the most contact with students than any other entity on campus. So I think that's important when we start thinking about why writing.
Yeah. I'm going to conflate my last two questions into one question, which is looking ahead. I know you said you don't typically make predictions, but I'm wondering what is exciting about Gen AI and maybe what scares you? I mean, you sound very brave and optimistic when you talk about generative AI, but is there anything that scares you, and what would you say is the trajectory of generative AI in higher ed going forward?
Right. So the trajectory, you know, like you say, I'm not going to make a prediction, but I think this is a tech like any other tech that, you know, first of all, we've got the narrative of this is going to be the end of humankind, or this is going to be the savior of humankind. And we hear that with, you know, all sorts of technologies. And where do we usually end up? Somewhere kind of in the middle, and, you know, it does what it does. I also think we have to remember that a system like an AI system, an AI platform, does what it's programmed to do. Right? The system is the system because it was designed to be the system. And so I don't worry about it suddenly doing other things. Now, that said, what I always look forward to is that what comes next question. And I think sometimes that what comes next question has to operate out of bounds. And so, you know, when Twitter was designed, there was an intent for what it was going to be used for. But users used it for something completely different. And so it became something different. So I think a lot of what happens next with Gen AI is going to have a lot to do with how it gets used. And I think the best places it gets used is when it starts to disrupt those sort of assumed institutional patterns of what we're supposed to do. And like I said, my perspective is, if all we're going to do is use this to be more efficient at what we've always done, that to me seems kind of pointless. It's to ask that next generation of questions of what is it going to do next?
What can it do?
What can it do next? And I think part of that also, going back to the questions of what are we doing with our students with this, that we as educators have to remember that we are teaching the next iteration of designers of these AIs, that it's going to be our students who build the next sets of these things. So as we're teaching responsible use and as we're teaching experimentation, what we're also setting is the foundation for what they're going to build next. And that to me is really important. What are my fears? My fears specifically are that it's just going to be, you know, a better mousetrap, that we're just going to keep doing the same things. I think that'll be generational, too. I think that as the demographics of who's teaching in classrooms changes, that we'll see more and more influx of AI into classrooms.
In innovative ways.
In innovative ways. I also think, and I'm going to come back to that in just one quick second, but I also think that a lot of it's going to have to do with how the Gen AI industry provides platforms. Right. The academy is always one of those places where something really cool happens out in the world, this technique, and then we figure out how do we adapt it to teach our students. So I think that, you know, particularly in writing, we're not sitting around going, there's not a point where you and I have had a conversation or I've had a conversation with comp people where we've said, well, what do we want the next AI to do for writing studies? Right. We need to, you know. Several years ago, I had a grad class in digital media, digital technologies, and we asked, what do we want to see happen in the humanities with digital technologies? And that was when we created the Trace Innovation Initiative at UF, which was a humanities-based tech approach. And one of the first projects was a project called MassMind that ended up winning the NEH's largest tech grant. It's a mass mine drilling tool for assessing large quantities of social media data to answer humanities-based questions. And part of that grew from the opportunity to say, if we could build, what would we build? And fortunately, in that class, I had coders, I had designers, and so we built. So I think that a lot of what's going to happen, I think that there's an opportunity for things like UF's Trace Initiative or Michigan State's WIDE Center that Bill Hart Davidson runs. I think that, you know, the system that Jason Kreider is building at Texas A&M, where humanities folks are going to start making their own. And that to me, coding's a form of writing. Then, you know, why are we not teaching coding and writing? You know, there's so many things we could be doing with this. What worries me is that we won't.
That's the scary thing for you.
Right. That we'll just let it kind of, that we'll want to keep doing what we've always done because it's easy and familiar and change is scary. One of the things I think we have to be hyper alert to, though, as academics, is that as these new technologies are coming in, we cannot create a climate where those faculty who do not want to engage these technologies are made to feel obsolete. That we can't create a two-tiered faculty structure of those who are in and those who are out. We have to remember that those faculty have done amazing things for our students. They have built our programs. They have maintained our institutions. And they will continue to do so. They will continue to teach to their strengths. Students will benefit from those instructions. Research will benefit from that. And I don't want to create a conversation that says, if you're not bringing Gen AI into a writing classroom, somehow you're of no value to the institution any longer. I think that would be a massive mistake.
I love that sense of balance, and I think that it's critical. I can remember when I was big in service learning and someone asked, well, what if I don't want to do service learning? And then my answer was always, well, then don't do it. It's, you know, you do it because you care about it and you're passionate about it and you see what it can do for students. But if you have a different vision for what's going to excite students and what's important to them, you go with your vision.
Absolutely.
And that's critical to valuable teaching.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation. I really have enjoyed it, and you've given us so much to think about and continue thinking about. I'll remind folks that this episode has been a collaboration of Writing Across the Curriculum and the AI Initiative at Fort Hays, and also Teaching Innovation and Learning Technologies.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FHSU Tilt Talk. Subscribe on Spotify, Amazon, and check us out on the Tiger Learn blog or the Tilt social media pages for updates. We'll see you next time.